This is the takeaway for Tuesday, May 9th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It was after much anticipation in Washington, D.C., finally, the Clapper-Yates show. The U.S. Senate got to question the principal national security official, James Clapper, and the principal Department of Justice official in the middle of the Trump-Russia General Flynn scandal. Yates and James Clapper, former director of national intelligence, answered hours of questions. Yates testified that she believed Flynn had compromised himself so much that she sent repeated warnings about Flynn to White House counsel Donald McGahn.
We told him the third reason was is because we were concerned that the American people had been misled about the underlying conduct and what General Flynn had done. And additionally, that we weren't the only ones that knew all of this, that the Russians also knew about what General Flynn had done, and that this was a problem because not only did we believe that the Russians knew this, but that they likely had proof of this information. And that created a compromise situation, a situation where the national security advisor essentially could be blackmailed by the Russians.
Blackmailed. Did we know this before? Is it something new? Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, was the hearing yesterday confirmation or revelation?
There was a little bit of both. There was plenty of confirmation of things that had been in the press, John, and also some tidbits of some new information that's definitely going to help drive other investigations. Don't forget, this was the Senate Judiciary Committee. This is separate from the Intelligence Committee investigations that are also going on. So this information on Flynn and much, much more still at stake. Now, what did we learn that was new? One, you just heard Sally Yates, who was acting attorney general at the time, saying that it wasn't just that Michael Flynn had lied to Mike Pence about his conduct that was a problem, but that she went to White House counsel Don McGahn at the time, directly warned him in person that it was Flynn's underlying conduct, not just the lies, that were a problem.
To state the obvious, you don't want your national security advisor compromised with the Russians.
And that is obvious. I guess the question is, can Yates deliver a sense that, a lot of people knew this when and really should have acted way before they ended up doing so?
Sally Yates said that in her conversation with Don McGahn, the White House counsel, that he took it seriously, that he asked questions, that he said, should Flynn be fired? She said, that's not our call. That's the president's call. What we do know is there was that warning. We also know there was the warning from President Obama to President Trump much earlier after the election not to hire Flynn. That means the president was warned twice directly about Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn wasn't fired until 18 days after this meeting with Sally Yates that I'm describing. And of course, as you'd expect, John, in the intervening time, he had access to lots and lots of the most sensitive information and sensitive meetings as national security advisor. We learned a couple of other things that were new also. James Clapper, you mentioned, the former DNI, confirmed that the United States got information from European intelligence services in the spring of 2015 detailing contacts between Trump campaign officials and Russians. And he said, they're quite sensitive. That's all he would say about them. And something else that was also new, that the FBI investigation, the potential criminal investigation about coordination, possible collusion, we don't know what, that James Comey has confirmed, John, may include investigation into Donald Trump's business dealings with Russians. Lindsey Graham asked James Clapper if he'd seen any evidence of business ties with Russians that were a concern. And Clapper refused to answer that question, saying it could impact an investigation. That's new. We don't know how that would impact an investigation or what investigation he's necessarily talking about. Presumably, it's the FBI investigation, since, according to the questioning, this was new to him. He wasn't read into that information earlier. But that information was new and seemed to slip by a lot of people. And, John, the last thing we learned, maybe this isn't so new, is that the president seems to take all of this extremely seriously and very, very personally. He issued a burst of tweets immediately after the hearings ended, saying that there was nothing new new in these hearings at all, calling allegations of collusion a complete hoax. What the president is implying is that collusion is the only level of interaction that could potentially be problematic. And that's just not the case. There doesn't have to be, there won't have to be evidence of conspiratorial cooperation to undermine the election between Trump officials and Russians for this to be a very, very big problem, not only for intelligence, for national security, but also potentially for the FBI.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Four-star General Michael Hayden served Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama in top intelligence posts and has watched all of this unfold, including the curious self-destruction of General Michael Flynn, a one-time colleague. General Hayden, welcome.
Oh, thanks very much. Good to be back, John.
So lots of details here and, you know, added to the details that we already know. Can I just get a general assessment of General Michael Flynn? You've worked with him. I mean, you know him, right?
Yeah. Mike was tactically brilliant, operationally very sound. He was Stan McChrystal's two, his head of intelligence for all that terrorist hunting that was so successful from our Joint Special Operations Command. But I think Mike coming into the national scene was very unfamiliar turf for him. And I don't think he was a very good fit for the job that the president selected him for.
Except even beyond that, I mean, it seems as though, as you say, he had a distinguished career within the Pentagon and then moving into the national security realm, did what a lot of people in the Pentagon do, you know, anticipated some sort of political career beyond the Pentagon and so began campaigning for a Republican. Okay, that's nothing terribly unusual, but it seems as though at a certain point, he just, I don't know, he drank some sort of Kool-Aid and all of a sudden he's just talking to the Russians. What's going on here?
Well, you know, at the tactical level, breaking China is occasionally very, very useful. At the national geostrategic level, breaking China can be very, very dangerous. And I think what we had here was a man whose entire life experience was in one environment, and he took the tools that seemed to have worked over there to the national level. And, you know, there are an awful lot of minefields out there, and I don't mean people ought to get them. I just mean this is the kind of stuff that has to be carefully, closely coordinated. And, John, let me give you an additional thought, all right? This was a perfect storm. General Flynn coming out of government a bit angry, feeling a bit disrespected, passionate about some things, working for a president who had those same attitudes. They kind of fed off of one another. Hence my reasoning back before all this, I thought Mike was an ill fit for the job because what President Trump needs is someone to calm him down, not someone to accelerate him. And I fear as if we've got this convergence and it just headed to a very dark place. You probably tell, John, I'm trying to be very careful here not to condemn or criticize a fellow officer who's had a great career, but clearly, based upon particularly the events of yesterday, made some serious missteps here.
Although, you know, he watched McChrystal go up in flames for talking to a magazine. I mean, I just, you know what I mean?
Look, and one of the subplots is that early in the transition, when the Trump campaign began to bring in some of the more traditional national security types, you know, the ones who kind of knew how the plumbing worked here in Washington, during one of those early transition meetings, the leader of the so-called landing team for national security specifically told General Flynn, be careful talking to the Russians. Let me get you the CIA biography on Ambassador Kislyak. And so there were already these kinds of signs, I think, that folks more familiar with how this stuff works were a bit ill at ease with what they saw happening.
All right. So let's look at the hearings. What did you make of the body language from Clapper? I mean, he did not want to be there.
No, of course he didn't want to be there. He's recently retired, but Jim went out and did his duty, and you saw the Jim Clapper that I know, incredibly honest, slightly irascible, and just speaking very, very candidly, because look, you saw two career government professionals testifying yesterday, Jim and Ms. Yates. And John, I've got to tell you, the only safe haven for a government professional in issues like this is the truth. And I knew when I saw the lineup for this hearing, one, this was not going to be a happy day for the White House, who have tried to spin all of this in every possible direction. And number two, this wasn't going to settle things down. This was going to excite this issue.
Since you mentioned truth, I mean, you know, a lot of people remember that when asked by Ron Wyden about the domestic surveillance, you know, James Clapper did not tell the truth. Is this a matter of, you know, fool me once, fine, but fool me twice, no way?
Look, Jim is always honest. That was a horrible answer to an even more horrible question, a question that Senator Wyden already knew the answer to. In fact, everybody on the dais and all the staffers behind the people on the dais knew the answer to the question. Senator Wyden wanted to get Jim to admit a classified program in open session, and Jim handled the question incredibly clumsily. I think he'd like to do a do-over, go back to the bag, get another ball, and hit it again. But it wasn't dishonesty.
Going to Yates now, first of all, without talking about Yates for a second, based on what we know with the addition of Yates' testimony, did DOJ warn the Trump administration about Michael Flynn to the extent that they should have taken swift action?
So John, pre-hearing, before yesterday, my take on this was, if the acting attorney general calls the White House counsel and says, I got to come talk to you right away, that should be a tectonic shift inside the West Wing of the White House. And then yesterday we learned that happened not once, but twice in personal meetings and an additional phone call. And the tone of the conversation was intensely serious and that this is a big deal. I searched for explanations as to then what happened, and I come up with two or three that created that inexplicable 18-day delay. One, I think, was just chaos and incompetence, all right? It's still not all that tightly run a White House, but back then it was chaotic. Second, I think there was contempt for the members of the former administration that were kept on. We don't have to pay attention to these people. And then I do think that the president has a powerful sense of loyalty to people who have been very loyal to him. And as you've already expressed, they did have that bond, General Flynn and President Trump. And I think all three of those got in the way of making the kind of swift decision that was necessary. And only the public outing of the plot line forced the issue.
All right. So we've got a warning from the President Obama to President-elect Trump 48 hours after the election, which, you know, make what you will of the specific language. Then you have, as you've just itemized, all these other warnings about Flynn. Spicer yesterday in the White House briefing says, you know, it was a joke. It was an offhanded comment. What do you make of that assessment to the American people?
Look, I don't want to be overly dark here, all right?
Please be overly dark.
This White House has a strained relationship with the truth, and they find it they find themselves unable just simply to admit facts that seem obvious to the rest of us. What, 10 days ago, John, you had the President of the United States still questioning whether or not the Russians were the ones who actually did all this stuff.
Finally, you and I are old enough to remember the 18 minutes on the White House tape and the Nixon Watergate scandal. We got the 18 days now. Do you think Flynn was capable of being blackmailed, as Yates finally said in her testimony?
I think it's a vulnerability. And John, we're really sensitive about this stuff. I think most Americans would be shocked at the kind of information people like Mike Flynn, me, Jim Clapper, have to give over to the government, and things that you and I would think, no one would ever, could ever use that to blackmail me. I would never, you know, yield to that kind of pressure. The government takes very, very seriously. And so it's not a moral judgment as to whether Mike would or would not have caved, all right? It's just simply, we don't go there. We don't give people clearances who have these vulnerabilities, no matter the strength of their character.
General Hayden, thank you so much.
Okay, John, thank you.
This is not a Muslim ban. Its text doesn't have anything to do with religion. Its operation doesn't have anything to do with religion.
What he said was that we have a problem with Muslims in the United States.
The only thing they've got are to reach back and say, well, we know, despite its text and operation, what was in the president's head.
What he said was, I'm going to ban Muslims, period. And then he said, I'm going to do it by talking territory, not Muslim, which is what he did, Your Honor.
He's never repudiated what he said about the Muslim ban. It's still on his website. The district court here found that it's on his website, campaign website, today.
That debate ought to be left where it belongs, in the political arena, and this injunction should be vacated.
Arguments in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday over the Trump travel ban, one of a number of Trump policies that will apparently be decided in the courts. But we learned over the weekend that someone not in a courtroom but in the Texas State House wants to help. Governor Greg Abbott says he'll help enforce the Trump immigration policies regarding undocumented immigrants in local communities. Governor Abbott declared he would overrule local law enforcement officers found to be resisting presidential orders. And Abbott says his order has real teeth.
Now, this law imposes penalties up to $25,000 per day, and it can lead to jail time and removal from office for any official who refuses to comply with the ban on sanctuary cities.
Criminal and civil penalties for local government entities and law enforcement that fail to comply with the federal immigration laws. That's what the governor has proposed and the legislature has confirmed. So how does that sit with Texans who carry a badge? In most cases, not very well. Art Acevedo is chief of police in Houston. He says the Trump policies have already made his job harder, and this will make it that much worse.
It's troubling when the legislature decides that they will not allow police chiefs to run their organizations consistent with the priorities and the values of the community that we serve at the local level.
And your mission at the local level is sort of peace and tranquility in Houston, and you've got a lot of things to deal with, not simply the policy of the federal government, right?
Well, that's right. And if you think about immigration enforcement as the sole purview of the federal government, and you know, my community wants us to have a laser focus on public safety, on fighting violent crime and property crime, and we do that regardless of one's socioeconomic status or their immigration status. We don't care if they're documented or undocumented. If they're out committing violent crime or property crime, we're going to come after them with our very limited resources to try to keep Houston safe. And this does not help with that mission.
And if there is a chilling effect from whatever quarter on people cooperating and speaking with the police, what does that do to your job?
Well, I mean, it's a loss in terms of the safety, the collective safety of Houstonians, and by extension of all Texans, when folks go further into the dark, go further into the shadows, and are afraid to come forward. Luckily for the people of Houston, they have a police chief that is an immigrant himself, that is bilingual, and that will continue to speak to this community, letting them know that the only ones that need to fear us are criminals, those that are out violating our criminal statutes. And if they're a victim, if they're a witness, or they know something, they need to come forward, because we're here to serve everyone equally.
Is there a Texas Rangers that the governor can call out to basically stop you from doing your job?
Well, I mean, there the law includes some criminal statute, criminalizes leadership, criminalizes prioritization, criminalizes police chief being telling, you know, someone that I would call one of those outliers. I guarantee you most cops aren't going to go around asking people, let me see your papers, if they have an accent and don't speak English. Matter of fact, they understand that people don't even have to answer any question regarding their immigration status. And so this is a more political theater, nothing else. But at the end of the day, there is a part of the law that says that they can actually charge with the Class A misdemeanor if we have a policy saying they can't ask. But what they forgot is that racial profiling is absolutely a violation of law. It's a violation of our Constitution. And our officers, if they decide to go out and start asking everybody about their papers, they better be careful, because we will not tolerate racial profiling in any form.
Now, you know, I'm in support of, you know, following the law, but you have a balancing act here, right? And it's been going on for a long time, many years. Can you describe that?
you know, here are the unintended consequences. Look, there's no doubt in my mind that this is having a chilling effect. I know that because we've already looked at the first 3 months of data from last year, 2016, versus the first 3 months in 2017, and we've already seen a 42.8% reduction in the reporting of rapes by Hispanic members of the Hispanic community, while there was an increase.
Wait a minute,
in
back up there. 42%?
42.8% through the first 3 months of 2017 versus the first 3 months of 2016. And we've also seen the same thing as it relates to all Part 1 crimes where Hispanics we've seen a reduction in the reporting by Hispanics and an increase by everyone else. So the unintended consequence of this political theater is the fact that Texans are less safe. All Texans are less safe. And then the unintended consequences are that if you see your if that nanny, that the gardener, the pool person, somebody working in someone's house that's undocumented, sees someone's little son or granddaughter at the school bus stop, kidnapped by some pedophile and thrown into a van, that person
or even hit by a car and just, you know, or get on their bike gets into an accident.
People will not want to be fully participate in society, and that's a loss for everybody. And quite frankly, if they were interested in immigration enforcement, they don't need to tack that on to state and locals. All they have to do is suspend the business license of anyone they catch. But we know that this is, we know what this is all about. It's about the next primary election and not about public safety, because if it was about immigration, they didn't need to include us. They could have simply taken on the businesses that employ folks that are undocumented. But that's not going to happen anytime soon, as far as I can tell.
Finally, Chief, there's a constituency that's going to listen to this and say we just cherry-picked the most leftist police chief in the state of Texas and found you there in Houston. And, of course, you're going to say what you're saying.
You know, I say hogwash. My job, my sworn duty is to speak based on my 31 years of service. This has been my entire adult life, and I can tell you that as the first vice president of Major City Chiefs, which comprises over 65 biggest departments in the country, this is our collective judgment. And the sad truth is that people that have dedicated their lives, their entire lives, adult lives, to keeping Americans safe, what we've had to say has had zero bearing on this debate. And what will happen is that we will now suffer the consequences in terms of a less safe community.
All right, Chief. Well, you better get back to it there in Houston.
We will. We're going to continue to build bridges and not burn them.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys, and keep up the good work.
Art Acevedo is chief of police in Houston, Texas. The governor's office in Texas told us yesterday that, quote, civil penalties are enforced by the Texas Attorney General's office and removal is an option available to local prosecutors, not the Texas Rangers. This is The Takeaway. You know, the story of life on the lands of North America does not begin once upon a time. It starts with a contented grunt, accompanied by some bird song and the wind whistling down the prairie for millions of years. Consider the story of the majestic bison, our country's national mammal as of a year ago, perhaps a paltry prize for a species surviving an extraordinary ordeal.
We used to have more than 50 million bison in North America. They were here for hundreds of thousands of years before the first humans crossed over the Bering Land Bridge. And they were really a major kind of keystone species for the entire continent.
Ah, familiar tune. And that was Amy Martin, who's been reporting on bison in Montana for her podcast Threshold. Thanks to extensive repopulation efforts, from near extinction, there are now more than 20,000 wild bison roaming the U.S. and hundreds of thousands being raised for meat. But the bison may not fit comfortably back in its old habitat. In Yellowstone Park, for instance, the National Park Service slaughtered 1,200 bison this winter, about a fifth of the park's herd, to prevent overgrazing and other imbalances to the ecosystem. Amy Martin devoted the whole first season of her podcast to this heroic story of bison management.
The bison in the Yellowstone area, some of them have contracted a disease which they originally caught from cattle called brucellosis. And because of that, it's not a simple thing to relocate them. We can't just, you know, load them up onto trailers and ship them elsewhere. They have to go through a quarantine process first. The trick is we have these quarantine facility all set up and ready to go on the Fort Peck Reservation in Montana. But this year it sat empty because of controversy about using it.
Tell me about the cattle rancher you talked to for this piece, who represents one of the very strong positions being held by people in the West.
Yeah, so her name is Druska Kinky, and she is a cattle rancher who ranches just north of Yellowstone, and she is very devoted to her cattle, and she's also someone who has an interest in wildlife. So one of the things that she really wanted people to understand is that her opposition to bison is not knee-jerk. It's got some complexity to it.
I think people from away from the state, away from this area, need to understand that nothing is simple. Nothing's cut and dried. We are not a bunch of people out here that don't care about wildlife, that don't care about the land, that don't care about our own cattle. We care very deeply about all of that. And we try and make a balance, and it's hard. It's not simple.
This is where the story gets really complicated, because there are concerns about competition for grass. There's concern about, you know, whether or not this disease really can be contained. But I think the deeper issue here, after I've spent 18 months reporting on bison almost exclusively, and what I feel like I've come to understand is that there really is a cultural issue here. It's about worldview and culture almost more than anything else. There's just a feeling among many ranchers that bison are a relic from the past, and that their fate was decided in the 1800s, and that we just need to accept that and move on.
Now, I'm naive, and I live in the East, okay, so let me just stipulate that right up front. But that sounds suspiciously like the kinds of arguments that are used to justify the neglect of Native Americans in the West and in the Heartland.
Well, you know, exactly. I mean, that there's this really strange parallel that as European Americans were decimating the bison herds, we were also, you know, violently oppressing Native Americans. And there has been a parallel story between bison and Native Americans for a long time. And, you know, there are a lot of Native American tribes now that are saying, hey, you know, this animal is incredibly resilient, and we as people are incredibly resilient. And bringing that back, the bison, is a key part of returning strength to Indian country. And so I think that it is an issue in which the controversies of the last century are bleeding into the first. And we haven't really decided in some ways how comfortable we are with Native American sovereignty. And at the same time, we're not really sure how comfortable we are with having this animal be wild and free roaming.
The director of the Fish and Game Department for Montana's Fort Peck Tribes, Robbie Magnan, confirms that there is this parallel track between Native Americans and the population of bison, and it's actually chilling to hear him talk about it.
Buffalo has taken care of Native Americans since the beginning of the time, and now the buffalo need help. So as a Native American, I feel it's our responsibility that we put a hand to help them, to pay back the favor.
Is that a widely held view?
You know, I visited four different reservations in Montana, and I would say I heard something along those lines from everyone I spoke with. I think, you know, just like any other group of people, there's a diversity of opinions and a diversity of feelings about bison. But I really, in my reporting, I didn't find one Native American person who didn't think that bringing back bison was important.
You spoke with Rick Wallen, who's bison project manager for Yellowstone National Park. I'm wondering, is it safe for the bison to leave the national park area?
Well, it's not safe right now because, you know, bison are meant to roam. You know, that's where the home on the range song came from. And that means that they have to have space to roam. And, you know, I think Rick is concerned about their safety when they leave the park because we're not really sure where they can go.
There's no place for them to immigrate. There's no tolerance for wild bison in very many landscapes outside Yellowstone.
It's all about humans. It's just a matter of how much space we give them and how many of them we're willing to tolerate. They're a really big animal, and they can be up to 2,000 pounds. They can run up to 30 miles an hour. And so sometimes, you know, we've tried restoration in different areas, and people get nervous about it, and then herds get culled down. But a lot of the people that are working to restore bison say it's all about just finding the right pieces of public land where the animals are not likely to be in conflict with humans. You know, there would still be some management. You know, I don't think anyone thinks that we're going to have bison wandering, you know, through Central Park. But there are, you know, despite how many people we have in this country, we also have a lot of public land. And so a lot of people that are working to restore them say we could bring them back there.
Amy Martin is host of the podcast Threshold. Thanks so much, Amy.
Thank you for having me on.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio. The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com.
Supporters there of South Korean presidential candidate Moon Jae-in at his last campaign rally on Monday. Today, he's been elected the country's new president by a vote of more than 40%. Former President Park Geun-hye now sits in a 115-square-foot jail cell on corruption charges. Tim Shorrock, a journalist who spent part of his youth in South Korea and has been reporting from Korea for The Nation, says this election caps the long journey toward real democracy in South Korea.
This is a huge defeat for the conservatives. It's a massive defeat for the party that was the party of the last president who was impeached. People here were sick of the corruption, were sick of the close ties with the large conglomerates called J-Ball that rule this economy. It's just a complete repudiation of Park Geun-hye, who was just impeached and is now in jail awaiting charges, you know, awaiting trial on charges of corruption and misuse of power. And I think people expect quite a lot out of Moon Jae-in. They've heard a lot from him in the last couple months, particularly about how he wants to deal with North Korea. He wants to have a return to the kind of policies that were followed by his progressive predecessors, Kim Dae-jung, Noh Moo-hyun, who he worked for, who adopted what's called the Sunshine Policy toward North Korea, which was based on using economic ties and cultural ties to kind of decrease the tensions and to move forward with relationships with North Korea as opposed to the standoff we see today.
Park Geun-hye represented, symbolically or otherwise, the income inequalities that had grown up in very prosperous South Korea. How can Moon Jae-in address those?
Well, he's been talking about a lot of programs in terms of workers and the economic situation here. He's been talking about raising the minimum wage, for example, shortening work hours, allowing workers more flexibility and more vacation time. You know, he wants to put in place programs for parents, you know, women who become pregnant, child care programs so women can work and have child care. All those kind of programs that, you know, benefit working people. He's been talking about that a lot.
Is Moon Jae-in likely to take a tough line in direct talks with President Trump and American officials? And what's his profile likely to be in the region related to Japan and Thailand and the Philippines, where there's a very colorful leader, and of course, China?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think he sees himself as, you know, by talking to North Korea and decreasing tensions, as he told me the other night, he believes that's going to help the United States, which, you know, I agree with him. It certainly would. If he could help decrease tensions with North Korea, that would help. And he thinks Trump would be good with that. So I don't think he's going to take really a tough line with the United States. I think he said that South Korea should take the lead in diplomacy and negotiating and talking to North Korea. It should be South Korea in the lead, not the United States, not Japan, not China. And because, after all, this is their country. The South and North Korea are part of the same nation. They've been divided for, you know, 70 years, but that's what his position is. So it's not really a tough line toward the United States, but he's, you know, they're still very concerned about the North Korea having nuclear weapons and its missiles, and he thinks that by negotiating and talking and having some kind of economic exchanges and building bridges economically, that may decrease the tension and therefore work toward de-escalation and denuclearization in North Korea.
Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Tim Shorrock has been reporting from Korea for The Nation. Yesterday, the White House announced its first 10 judicial nominees for the more than 120 open positions in the lower courts across the country. The Trump administration has plans to roll out more nominations over time to fill the 129 vacant judicial seats, which exist in all 11 circuits and Washington, D.C. Does this get the federal judiciary up and running after years of politically motivated inaction? Merle Chertoff is executive director of the Justice and Society Program at the Aspen Institute. She says it's a start.
The judges that President Trump announced this week are mainstream conservative judges. This represents a return to the type of judges who were selected during the administration of George W. Bush. But they are all judges who are in the mainstream, highly credentialed, went to excellent law schools, many of them clerked on the U.S. Supreme Court, several law professors in the group. I think that we've all heard that Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society, who has been around for a long time, has had an active role in the selection of these nominees. He's very professional. He knows the people that he's selecting. So these are all mainstream selections.
So within this group, you don't detect a split or a reveal of a split within the conservative constituency over who's a real true-blooded conservative and who might be more moderate?
There don't seem to be any real outliers in this first group. It's relatively diverse. There are three women in the group, one African-American. There's been some speculation that a couple of these picks are being groomed for the Supreme Court, but there's really no way to know at this phase.
Are there any particular candidates that you'd like to speak to us about where they come from, where they might be headed, and whether they have a profile within the judicial community?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are some interesting things with respect to these judges. First of all, you can't detect any grand scheme here or triangulation. Joan Larson is being selected to go up to the Sixth Circuit. She replaces Judge McKeague, who's taking senior status. He was a George Bush appointee to the district court and a George W. Bush appointee to the Sixth Circuit. So that's a one-for-one replacement of a relatively conservative judge with a relatively conservative judge. Kevin Newsom, who has been nominated for the 11th Circuit, he's got a very diverse background. He clerked for Judge Scanlon, who is viewed as a conservative judge in the Ninth Circuit. But he was also a clerk to Justice Souter on the Supreme Court and was mentored by Larry Tribe at Harvard Law School, who has impeccable liberal credentials. So you can see that there is not a particular discernible pattern with respect to the way these judges are being selected. One thing that does unify them is that most of them have spoken at Federalist Society meetings and are known quantities to the people over there.
And what do you make of the vacancies that remain? And what kind of an impediment is that in the procession of federal court cases on their way to the Supreme Court, or maybe not on their way to the Supreme Court?
Well, there are a lot of openings, and that's a big opportunity for the Trump administration. Every president tries to remake the court in his own image, but the judges have a way of doing their own thing once they're on the court, because the judges do have a way of finding their own place once they get onto the court. One of the reasons that President Obama was so interested in diversity was to try to get those different perspectives coming to the bench. This president, I think that you're going to see a return to the notion of originalism, a view that you follow precedent and that you don't make up the law quite as much. But again, those types of activities really only occur in a very small fraction of cases.
Merle Chertoff is executive director of the Justice and Society Program at the Aspen Institute. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Merle Chertoff is Executive Director of the Justice and Society Program at the Aspen Institute. In the months after the election campaign, it's probably fair to say that virtually every American has done some soul searching about the positives and negatives of a new government that few predicted during the campaign. As President Trump has revealed himself more and more over time, we've debated numerous principles of what defines freedom, security, and the very soul of America. For immigrants, undocumented or not in particular, the soul searching has become a more urgent question. Am I still welcome here in this country?
Indians and other South Asians, we occupy this really strange, seemingly contradictory space, okay, in the American cultural imagination. On one hand, we're perceived as smart, as successful, well-behaved. On the other hand, we are the presumed threat.
Reporter Arun Venugopal has asked himself these questions while exploring the post-election landscape for WNYC Radio. He recently traveled to Olathe, Kansas, a Kansas City suburb. You may recall that in February, just a month after the inauguration, a white man shot two Indian immigrants, allegedly telling them, quote, "Go back to your country." Of course, they were already in their country, a place we might now call the United States of Anxiety. It's a real place all around us. And it's also the title of a recurring series from our co-producer WNYC News and WNYC Studio. In this episode out today, Arun discovers that in the South Asian community in Olathe, Kansas, the A in United States of Anxiety is familiar and now seems to be always close at hand.
When American jingoism gets stirred up, when it really goes into overdrive, it often goes looking for people who look like me. It happened in 1980. I was 7 years old during the Iran hostage crisis, and a bunch of bigger kids surrounded me on the streets and demanded to know if I was from Iran. And a backlash happened again in 2001.
I'm at a Mesa gas station near 80th Street and University. An employee was shot and killed. You can see behind me.
The first victim of a hate crime killing after 9/11 was Balbir Singh Sodhi, a Sikh man originally from India who'd saved enough money to buy a gas station in Arizona. He was outside planting flowers around the edge of the gas station when a guy came by in his pickup. The man had told his friends he was going to go out and shoot some towel heads. He shot Sodhi 5 times. That was September 15th, just 4 days after the World Trade Center had fallen. 15 years later, in a suburb of Kansas City, Srinivas Kuchibhotla was the first victim of a hate crime killing after the 2016 election. His wife, Sunayana, stood before camera crews not long after the shooting.
I don't know what to say. We've read many times in newspapers of some kind of shooting happening everywhere. And we always wondered, are we doing the right thing of staying in the United States of America? But he always assured me that only good things happen to good people.
I'd never been to Kansas. I hadn't even realized there were a lot of Indians there. So I made a trip. And I found myself spending an afternoon with a couple locals at the Woodside Health and Tennis Club.
It's been a very good place to raise our family. And it's been marvelous professionally for me. It's logistically a very easy and straightforward and simplified life. We've been blessed with a number of good friends.
This is Raj Bala. He's a law professor at the University of Kansas. He's written 13 books. His wife, Kara Tan Bala, runs the Seven Pillars Institute.
We are a think tank focused on the education, research, and promotion of financial ethics.
They're both members of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Society for Asian Affairs in England. Not impressed? He also recently ran the marathon in 3 hours and 42 minutes, and she was just named one of 50 Kansans you should know. We sat outside, like civilized folk do, drinking juice as people played tennis nearby.
The main reason we came here was to raise our daughter in a healthy environment, and I wanted to run a farm. So we bought a farm, and We kept chickens and have fruit trees, and all the neighbors were very welcoming, farmers too, people who lived in the country, and we were very happy.
Raj is half Indian, half Scottish. Kara is Malaysian Chinese. They met at Oxford, got married at the United Nations Chapel in New York, and moved to Kansas City in 2003. They pretty much epitomize what we think of as cosmopolitan, except that they live in Kansas instead of Manhattan.
This is not the Kansas that we moved to in 2003. It has changed.
One of the ways it's changed, he says, concerns its relationship with violence. The state has become more permissive when it comes to the rights of gun owners. And on July 1st, this summer, a concealed carry law goes into effect on campuses across the state.
Meaning that concealed weapons can now come into the classroom. They can even come into my office. And many of us on the faculties around the region's institutions, including myself, you know, didn't like that, and we still don't like that. We're worried. We never would have anticipated in 2003 the concealed carry coming on.
There's another thing. One of Raj's areas of specialty is Islamic law, Sharia law. He's written a textbook about it, and his expertise is such that he also teaches the subject to U.S. Special Ops Forces at Fort Leavenworth. He's that good. But among the general population, and especially among some conservatives, it doesn't go over too well. And people have started rumors about him, that he tries to convert his students to Islam, which is silly, not least because he's Catholic. But all these things have built up his concerns. His wife is worried too, especially after Srinivas Kuchibhotla was killed.
And so I did write to my congresswoman, my senators, after the shooting, and I said, I really don't feel safe anymore for my husband. I used to feel safe. I never worried about it, but now I worry. So I got a reply back from the congresswoman defending the Second Amendment. And I never got a reply back from the senators.
Now, after years of living here, raising their daughter here, and generally thriving, they are seriously considering leaving Kansas and the country.
It just made me feel as if my voice wasn't being heard in a very conservative state, and that perhaps it was time to just take a break from the country and come back when things get better. I know things go in cycles, so the pendulum has swung really one way, quite extreme, and we're waiting for it to swing slowly back.
From Olathe, Kansas, Karathan Bala with thoughts about this United States of Anxiety, reported by Arun Venugopal. Thanks to our co-producer, WNYC News, along with WNYC Studios, producer of the United States of Anxiety. You can listen to the complete episode of the United States of Anxiety Culture Wars starting today. Find it at wnyc.org/anxiety or at any podcast source. If you want to be a part of the series, 844-745-TALK. Call 844-745-8255. And finally today, let's cast off anxiety altogether. Did you hear Bill Clinton is co-writing a thriller with author James Patterson? Oh my goodness. Pick an author, pick a president. Tell us the title of the novel they'd write together.
This is Nate Surrey from Westfield, New Jersey. How about Cormac McCarthy and Jimmy Carter? No Country for Peanut Farmers.
This is Ramona from Portland, Oregon. And if Abraham Lincoln and Mario Batali wrote a cookbook, they could call it the Spaghettisburg Address.
My name is Alex. I'm from Bothell, Washington, and I think it should be R.L. Stein and Barack Obama, and they should write a novel called Predator in the Skies.
Yeah, I've got one. Richard Milhouse Nixon's final memoir. He wrote 7 books himself. Co-written with Gabriel Garcia Marquez. 2,027 Days of Solitude. Today's Teacher's Day, folks, in the U.S., so take a moment to say thanks to the many teachers who are the reason you're all so clever and can read all of those authors. As always, give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.